You're listening to Talking Baseball with Ed Randall, presented by MLB.com. He's Ed Randall. He's talking baseball. What more do you need?
Hi, everybody. I'm Ed Randall, Big Ed and Nora's baby boy, and welcome back to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball. It was the mother of all pennant race collapses, the gold standard for September swoons, blowing a 6.5-game lead with 12 games to go. The 1964 Philadelphia Phillies are the only team since 1900 to squander a lead that large that late in the season. The 1951 and 1962 Dodgers and the 1978 Red Sox at least got to play in a playoff for the pennant. After their epic freefall, the Phillies went home and never came close again. Our guest wrote the book on the 64 Phillies, literally, called The 1964 Phillies, the story of baseball's most memorable collapse from McFarlane and Company, and our guest John Rossi. John, it's great to have you on the show. Thank you so much. Let's first put the Phillies in historical context. The 63 club won five of their last six, beating Marichal, Drysdale, and Johnny Padres to finish fourth in a 10-team league. Were there any lofty expectations for 1964?
Yes. Late in the last 2 months of the 63 season, Phillies were one of the best teams in the National League. And as a matter of fact, Buzzy Vavezzi, the general manager of the Dodgers, said, in all honesty, they were a better team than the Dodgers going into the championship. When the 64 season opened, and actually in the prelims for it, the Phillies were picked for third or fourth. But a couple of people, including, believe it or not, Sandy Koufax, said that they could be a real contender this year. And Koufax pointed to the fact that they had a top-notch pitching staff led now by Jim Bunning, who had come over that year. And he pointed to Bunning and to Chris Short and to Art Mahaffey and Dennis Bennett, who had shown flashes of brilliance. And then they even had Ray Culp in the pocket, hoping that he would come back. So, there was some talk, but nobody took it that seriously.
And one of the people that they did not count on, because he was a rookie and they had no idea how good he was going to be, this was Richie Allen's rookie year.
Well, Richie Allen had come up in September and played well. He hit pretty well, but only for a month. And he hadn't played third base, so the Phillies had tried to find a third baseman. They hadn't been able to do so. And so Mock put him, that is, manager Gene Mock, put him on third. And his argument was that Allen had started as a shortstop, and he said some other good players had started at shortstop and had been able to adjust. And he mentioned a fellow named Willie Mays, another fellow named Mickey Mantle, who started as shortstops, and another fellow named Joe DiMaggio, who started as a shortstop. So he said if Allen could play short, he could also play third. It was turned out to be a kind of risky thing, although Allen actually didn't do as badly as some people thought.
But his bat was something else.
Oh, he was that year, he probably had the best rookie year of any Philly player that I can remember.
Let's talk about the sports landscape in Philadelphia at the time. The National Hockey League was still 3 years away from expanding, doubling the number of teams, one of which would be the Philadelphia Flyers. So it was the Eagles and the 76ers and the Phillies. Where did the Phillies stand in terms of popularity in the city then?
They were the most popular sports team, partly because the city never really fell in love with professional basketball. They had a great love affair with college basketball, but that was a specialized audience in some case. And pro football, the team had won the championship in '60, and was a very good team, but it fell on hard times. And so, in effect, the Phillies were the most popular sports franchise in the city and the most followed in the city. Partly because there was really no competition.
Take us through the early part of the season, from the beginning of the year until the All-Star break, how the Phillies broke out of the gate and how well they played.
Well, they won 10 of their first 12 games. And I can remember this is when I was in the midst of writing my doctoral dissertation for University of Pennsylvania, and I got sidetracked because that season became so exciting. So I can remember many of the games. But anyhow, they started off very fast, and to the surprise of everyone, they didn't fade. And they got consistently good pitching and amazing clutch hitting from right through the lineup. Allen started off in a blaze, and they got solid hitting almost from everybody in the lineup. Tony Gonzalez, Cookie Rojas, who had been just a fringe player, suddenly blossomed. And so they were probably in and out of first place. I'd have to look it up, but in and out of first place most of the first half of the season. And what impressed you was that every good team that came in, that San Francisco, the Dodgers, Milwaukee, whoever, the Cardinals, whoever it was, they would beat them back. They would win the series. And it probably was around the middle of June that sports fans began to say maybe something special is happening in Philadelphia.
And there was attention also brought to the team at the All-Star game because Johnny Callison, their fine right fielder, came up to bat against Dick Raddatz in the All-Star game at Shea Stadium. Shea had just opened, and in the bottom of the ninth inning broke a 4-4 tie with a three-run game-ending home run, yep. And that brought more attention to the Phillies.
Well, if you think about it, within a span of a couple of weeks, they had Jim Bunning's perfect game against the Mets, followed a couple of weeks later by Callison's dramatic home run off one of the best relief pitchers in baseball. And I know for myself, I remember that very clearly. I remember thinking to myself, you know what? I'm going to have to really pay even closer attention because this team might just be the surprise of the league. Any doubts I had, and of course, like a lot of Phillies fans, were born pessimists.
of course.
Yeah, you know, I wrote a piece a while back about Philadelphia sports fan. I called it Negadelphia because I think we're the only city where if a team does well, we immediately begin to worry what's going to happen and go wrong.
You're always thinking the dishes are going to fall off the shelf.
That's absolutely, and crash all over. Right. So anyway, that's when I really started to believe. I followed that team very closely, but I really followed it from around right after the All-Star game on.
John Rossi is with us. He's written the wonderful book, The 1964 Phillies, The Story of Baseball's Most Memorable Collapse, from McFarland and Company. And from July 21st, after the All-Star break, until the beginning of the historic collapse, which we're going to talk about momentarily, this team, John, played 623 baseball. And then all of a sudden it stopped. But at that point in time, they were doing great. But yet, there were indications that there were problems that were existing in July that would rear their ugly heads in September.
Yeah. Well, one of the first things that in the opening weeks of the season, Ray Culp pitched a couple of games that looked like he was going to have a premier season. And he was followed by Dennis Bennett, who was a very talented left-hander. And again, the two of them, along with Bunning, looked like they were going to have the makings of a great starting staff. And then they were using Chris Short in relief, and he was so overpowering in relief that when Art Mahaffey kind of had in-and-out games, Mock turned to him as a starter, and he shocked everyone by blazing through almost every team that he pitched against. So it looked up until, I'd say, about the middle of July, right after the All-Star game, a few problems began to show up. One was that Culp began to complain about his sore arm, and Mock began to spot start him. And then Dennis Bennett, who was 9-4, if I remember correctly, at the All-Star game, and was talking about winning 20 games, he started to lose one game after another. And as a matter of fact, he did not win another game until about the first week of September. So they started to be problems, and then Mock had to scramble, and he got Mahaffey righted for a while. He began using Rick Wise, who was just a rookie and was only being kept because of Rule 5 at the time, and I think he was 19 years old, and he would spot start him against certain teams. He won five games in about a two-month period. But they were relying enormously on the bullpen and on Ed Roebuck and on Jack Walshen. and they were in almost every game, and Mock was having to go to the bullpen again and again. Now, you didn't see that because they would pull out these games. They would win these games in dramatic fashion. However, if you know, in retrospect, when I wrote the book and I looked back, I saw how many of those games from July and August, which they won, sometimes very dramatically, how many of those games were the result of the starters faltering and the bullpen saving the team.
I want to go back to high school, where I remember the teacher on the blackboard writing assets on one side, liabilities on the other. Tell us about the assets and liability of manager Gene Mock.
Well, I'm a great admirer of Mock. I tell the story that I came back from graduate school the day in 1960, the day that Gene Mock was hired to manage the Phillies, which in 1960, and that was an absolutely terrible, terrible team, one of the worst you could imagine, and got worse for about a year. But Mock used to run a manager's talk show, you know, where he would speak before the game, sometimes after the game. And it was the most interesting thing I remember in baseball at that time because it was like a tutorial. He would analyze why he did certain things and certain aspects of baseball. And so it was like, to me, it was like a graduate course in baseball. He was a great thinker. He was always a couple of steps ahead of everybody else. Sparky Anderson, pretty good manager in his own right, said that if Mock had a team equal to you, you didn't have a chance. He'd figure a way to beat you. You know, he was a good strategist. He was a great believer in playing for one run. Would go contrary today, but he always believed you play for one, you get three or four. And a lot of hit and running. The team didn't have a lot of stolen bases, but it had a lot of speed, so they were constantly in motion. That was his handling of people. He would be very good with certain rookies. I mean, he nurtured Johnny Callison into a great player. He nurtured Allen the first year. You know, he kept polishing up Allen, and despite errors and things of that nature. But I'd say one of his the biggest liability was he didn't really respect pitchers. He really thought pitchers were a strange breed. And he didn't think of them as true athletes the way he thought of others. He also was a very irascible character and occasionally he wouldn't denigrate his own players, but they would realize that just by his look or by some action, he would do what he thought of them. So he was not, except the people he set out to do it with, he was not a great handler of human beings.
Even though nobody ever questioned his baseball acumen.
No, nobody ever questioned. His baseball judgment was good. I don't know, I tell a story in the book, it's a fascinating one. The Phillies lost a game to the Pirates in the ninth inning in Pittsburgh. And Mock came out to protest. And the winning run had scored, and he came out to protest to the umpires. And he said to the umpires, that run didn't count because the Pirates had 10 men on the field. And the umpire said, well, what do you mean? And Mock said, well, Elroy Face had gone into the scoreboard where it was a bathroom there, and he said, that put 10 men on the field. And so that run couldn't count. And the umpire told him to go F himself and walked off. But that was the kind of thing. He knew the rule book sometimes better than the umpires.
Yeah, everybody has said he always had a great baseball mind. So now the Phillies, despite the fact that they're burning out the bullpen with Roebuck and Balshan, are 6.5 games ahead with 12 games to go. It looks like it's in the bag. They're going to go back to the World Series for the first time since 1950. This is long before divisional play. At what point did the city, the ball club, begin to recognize, wow, there's something going on here and it's not good?
Yeah. Well, they had been on a long road trip, and they managed to, I think they went 6-4 or something like that, and they won a dramatic, they lost a couple of games to the Dodgers in L.A., and they managed to win the last game. Jim Bunning won the last game in the road trip. And they came home with a 6.5 game lead to play Cincinnati on a Monday night. There were certain worrisome signs. One of them was that Bennett had won a couple of games, but he wasn't the Dennis Bennett that he had been before. I mean, he was kind of he was now a junk baller.
He wasn't dominating with his speed.
Although he pitched a shutout against the San Francisco in the first week of September, which is amazing given the power hitting lineup they had, Mays and Cepeda and McCovey and people like that, and Jim Ray Hart. But anyway, that was worrisome. The other thing that was worrisome is that Mock had gotten some wins out of Art Mahaffey through July and August, which filled in the gap. But Mahaffey was now having trouble warming up. He would warm up, and he wouldn't be able to get through the first inning. So they were constantly tinkering with this. They had him warm up shorter. Then they had him warm up longer. Then they had him come out on the mound before the game started and take extra warm-ups. And the other thing that happened is Culp was useless after the 15th of July. He claimed he had a sore shoulder. But Mock said that he didn't have a sore shoulder. He just was afraid to pitch.
Mm. And what an indictment.
Yeah, he said, I could see it in his eyes. Well, I mean, that's an awful thing to say. The other thing happened that began to get worried people is they got Frank Thomas from the Mets in August. And in a month, Thomas hit 7 home runs and drove in 30-some runs. And he played first base, which had been a problem the whole season. And he got hurt on a stupid play because Frank Thomas was not the brightest guy in the world anyhow. And he got hurt jumping back into the bag at second base and broke his finger. The Phillies went out to get Vic Power to fill in, and Vic Power, unfortunately, was not the Vic Power of the past anyhow. So there were some worrisome signs, although the Phillies had managed to get through September up to this homestand. So the thinking was all they had to do was win, there were going to be a 7-game homestand. All they had to do was win, say, 2 or 3 of those games, and they'd pretty much be set. And, of course, you know what happened next. They went, instead of not winning any of those two or three, they didn't win any of those games and went on to lose an extra set of games after that.
And one of the seminal moments was in that series, scoreless game, and an infielder named Chico Ruiz stole home with Frank Robinson at the plate, and that was the only run of the game, and the Reds beat the Phillies 1-0.
Yep, and I remember listening. That was not on television, that game. I remember listening to it, and the thing that sticks in my mind is I remember that play, but, it didn't register that this would be the ultimate thing. The thing that made me, Mahaffey pitched a great game. It was the best game he pitched in a month. And in the ninth inning, at the bottom of the ninth, this is one of those kind of things. The first batter up was Wes Covington, and Covington hit a ball off the scoreboard in right field. As you know, that was a huge scoreboard. It was a big right field. Been a home run in probably every other ballpark. It was hit so hard and far. He got to second, so they had a man on second. They're losing 1-0, and no outs. And the next batter was a fellow that the Phillies thought was going to be a hitter named John Hernstein, big guy, ex-football player. Now, here's where it's interesting. Mock normally would bunt in that situation, or he'd send somebody up to bunt, if not Hernstein. He always, he'd play for the tie on the grounds that maybe you play for that one, you get two, and you win. Instead, he let Hernstein swing away, and Hernstein popped the shortstop, so the runner didn't move. The next batter hit a ground ball to second. The man would have probably, if he had been moved to third, the runner would have scored. It would have been a tie game, and the next guy struck out. Nobody thought much of it. If you read the papers the next day, they lamented, the opportunity and this, but the wonderful game by Mahaffey. It wasn't until really the next game, because they got bombed the next game. It was the third game in the Cincinnati series when it was a back-and-forth game. And Ed Roebuck came in with the Phillies with a lead of about 5-4, I think it was, and threw a home run to Vada Pinson. And that home run gave the Cincinnati the lead. And it was also evidence that the bullpen was really kind of burnt out.
John Rossi is with us. He's written the 1964 Phillies, the story of baseball's most memorable collapse. Jim Bunning later said, quote, "The one thing we never got in 64 was the one performance, the one big hit, the one huge pitching performance that could have stopped the bleeding." And he also said after the Mets in 2007, John had a 7.5 game lead with 17 to go.
Remember that
and
well.
They could have replaced the Phillies in pennant lore. And Bunning said, "I don't ever want another baseball team to ever experience what we went through. No one should have to go through that."
Yeah. Well, that's true. You know, in my book, I went and I checked through the lineup. How did those players play the last? What was their record the last? 12 games of the season. As you know, they lost 10 in a row and then won the last two. But interesting thing is, sometime in September, Wes Covington was interviewed, and he said, "Now it's time for the old pros to step forward. You know, the young kids had brought us this far. Now it's time for the old guys like myself and to step." Well, Wes Covington hit about 117 those 12 games. The only two guys who hit in that 12-game stretch, and really in the 10 games, were the rookie Richie Allen, who hit well, and Johnny Callison, who played well, and young Alex Johnson, who was just up for about a couple of months, had a couple of key hits. But he's right. There was no dominating pitching performance, and nobody other than Allen and Callison showed any kind of spunk when it came to hitting. Just to interrupt you for a second, to me, watching those games and listening to those games and then reading about them and studying them, it really looked like after that Cincinnati series, they kind of tightened up.
Hmm. And the legacy of the collapse has forever been that Mock pitched Bunning and Short on short rest over and over again and was crucified for that, even though I recently spoke with Frank Thomas, and he felt that his injury also played a big part in the collapse.
Yeah, I think that's true because, again, you can't be sure, but he certainly would have been better than Vic Power, who did nothing in those games that he played. He was just shot as a player. I remember I hadn't seen Vic Power play that much because, you know, he was in the American League and we didn't see many American League games in Philadelphia in those days. And then I had seen him when he was with the A's and with the Yankees in the 50s and with the Kansas City in the 50s. And when I saw him again, when he came with the Phillies, I mean, he just looked like a player who was completely over the hill. But yeah, I think that the Thomas injury might have been a key one. But the other thing I think was that both Short and Bunning, perhaps if he had swallowed and taken a loss, that is, Mock had decided that I'll take a couple of losses, I'll pitch somebody, you know, he could have pitched Bobby Shantz, who had come over. He could have started Bobby Shantz in a game, let him go three or four innings and try to win a game with the bullpen and give them an extra day's rest. It might have been enough for them to win one or two games because Bunning came back and pitched a shutout in the last game of the season.
And here we are in Philadelphia with the pennant slipping away, and yet World Series tickets were printed and mailed.
Oh, yeah. I had a couple. Yeah, my uncle bought World Series tickets. Yeah, the city really went berserk, in a sense, in September. You know, they hadn't had much sports success other than the Eagles' victory. And this is the team that the city fell in love with because of the struggles to build it up. I mean, they had those awful seasons in 60 and 61, and when they set a record for losses in 61, 23 straight losses. And then they suddenly got better in 62, and then again in 63 they became very good. There was a love affair with the team, and when that team went through this collapse, it broke fans' hearts. And I traced the thing I wrote about, that Negadelphia idea, I traced that right to the collapse of the 64 team. It was almost as though the city said, "We're not going to give our hearts to a team anymore because you're only going to break it anyhow."
And we should also mention that the pennant race played out against a very combustible atmosphere outside the ballpark that summer.
Oh, yeah, yeah. a riot in August 64, the worst riot in Philadelphia history in quite a long time. He had to go back to the 19th century, which was a part racial and part kind of frustration of what was going on in the city and the country. And the ballpark, I mean, the riot was within about three-quarters of a mile of the ballpark. I remember going to a game in I have two clear memories. One, I went to a game, and I used to drive and park on a small back street because there was no parking, naturally. But I was told, don't take your car. And I went by public transportation. And the other thing I remember, and this is actually in the preface to my book, I met my wife at a wedding in August. And I used to joke with her. I used to say, do you remember the day we met? And she would say, no, not really. I said, Phillies beat the Pirates.
That's the kind of thing I would say.
Yeah. But anyway, our first date, about a week after our first meeting, we went downtown to a movie, and we're coming home. I'm driving up Broad Street, and a cop pulls me over, and he says, where the hell are you going? And I said, I'm going home. He said, don't you know there's a riot up here? So I had to divert around the riot. You know.
Wow.
Yeah. It was a remarkable summer, and that was a very likable team that Mock put together in 62 and 60, because they would find ways to beat you. You could just see how they frustrated. I mean, hit and running, safety squeezes. You can just see. I remember, I think it was Danny Murtaugh who was managing the Pirates at the time, and he said, you know, this team beat you by frustrating you.
Mm. And they, to really rub it in, after the 10 straight losses, they wind up winning the last two games.
Yeah.
And on the last day of the season, there was the possibility that there could actually be a three-team playoff,
right,
with the which has never happened,
yeah,
unprecedented, with Cincinnati, St. Louis, and the Philadelphia Phillies. So the Phillies, just to make the pain even worse, win the final two games and fall just short as the St. Louis Cardinals, after having lost two of their games at home to the woeful New York Mets, actually won the final game and moved on to the World Series and eventually a seven-game World Series victory over the New York Yankees. John, their place in history is forever,
yeah,
unfortunately, and so was the heartbreak.
Yeah, the heartbreak, right, and I remember the Mets collapse in 2007, which was largely a lot of it at the hands of the Phillies. I remember thinking, my God, will the Mets fans ever get over this?
Correct. And they've not gone to the World Series since that time, that collapse, when it looked like they had the opportunity to advance to the World Series. The Phillies would wait another 16 years before getting to the World Series in 1980 and winning their first World Series in more than 50 years. John, a terrific piece of work. Your recall is phenomenal. And thank you so much for being with me.
Okay, Ed. It was nice talking to you, and good luck in the future.
So that'll do it for John Rossi and myself on MLB.com. If you're on the move, thanks for the ride, and thanks for listening to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball.